Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out on an extremely hot afternoon. Paul, and thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. Paul and I were having this great time at brunch at El Churro, and I'm so programmed for 2 o'clock, I thought we had another hour to go. So all of a sudden, he looks at me and he says, are we going to sign my books after the talk? And I, oops. But I have to say the reason is that flights back to Maine from Arizona are difficult and usually leave late afternoon. So I think that I changed the time thinking that Paul would be flying out back to Maine, but actually he's doing a tricky thing, aren't you?
Yeah. I'm going to Denver to spend the night in a hotel. But it's a lot better than trying to sleep on a plane, especially since I have an event tomorrow in Portland, Maine.
Right. So we're lucky to snag Paul. It's been a while since he's been here. What is it? Probably 2018, something like that.
Boy, yeah, that's definitely before the pandemic, obviously. Yeah, you probably know better than I do.
Right. But anyway, we are just delighted to see him. And I love this book because we get a chance to visit not the coast of Maine, which so many Maine books are about, but we actually get to go into the middle of the state near Augusta. And we are looking at the, what's it called, the Big Pond?
Great Pond, which is part of the Belgrade Lakes system of ponds. And it's sort of a posh place that has a lot of history. And I've wanted to write a lake book for a long time just because there's sort of a culture, a lake culture that's kind of everywhere, you know? I mean, it's party boats and jet skis and cocktails at dusk and the whole deal. And I hadn't written one of those books yet. So it's like, okay, I want to do that one.
And also, it's a big part of camp culture because many people's whole experience of Maine, especially East Coasters, may be that they went to summer camp or sent their kids to summer camp. And so the Great Pond is a place that has, in the book anyway, at least one very old camp, and maybe kind of on rocky grounds right now?
No, they're actually... I don't know what happened to the camps during the pandemic, I have to say. But the camps are still going strong. They're ones with, you know, hundreds of 100 years of history. And, you know, I have this experience often of meeting people who will come up to me and say, oh yeah, I was a kid. When I was a kid, in New York, my parents sent me to Camp Bernoia or Camp Bombazine or Pine Island camps, you know, which are all on Great Pond. And I liked that part of the history that, you know, hopefully people who had that experience will pick up this book and, you know, get these nostalgic feels. We'll see.
It's bodies of water inland. I mean, Maine is a coastal state. It's also a border state. I think a lot of times we forget that Maine has a long border with Canada, and so they have some of the same border issues that we have. Also true of Minnesota. William Kahn Kruger writes about that really well, Montana and so forth. But I grew up in Chicago, and Lake Geneva was a place just north. I think it's actually in Wisconsin, but I'm not, isn't it? But it was very similar to the Great Pond in the sense that people had summer homes there. Very often they were handed down generation to generation. And, you know, there was a whole kind of lake culture that maybe today may be being eroded by bigger houses and, you know, a whole different kind of ethic going on. But in the book, you do have, you know, old Mainers, so to speak, but you also have some celebrities that are owning property around the Great Pond.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the celebrities in general are pretty good at keeping their profile low when they want to, but David E. Kelly and Michelle Pfeiffer had a cottage, as far as I know, on Great Pond for many years. Great Pond was the inspiration for the play on Golden Pond. So you imagine on Golden Pond, the tricky bit was on Golden Pond was not filmed in Maine, as is the case with almost every movie or television show that you've ever seen about the state of Maine has been filmed somewhere else. And on Golden Pond was filmed on Squam Lake in New Hampshire, probably for financial reasons, I would imagine. So you can't quite picture that.
Does Maine not do any sort of subsidy for film groups? Because, you know, New Mexico, for example, has a really great film subsidy thing, which is why a lot of books that you think should be filmed in Arizona aren't. And also Canada, that's the reason a lot of things like Joe Pickett are actually filmed in Vancouver. Actually Joe's in Alberta now that I think about it, not Vancouver, but they have big sound stages in Vancouver. But a lot of that is simply tax breaks and subsidies for film companies that make it worthwhile.
Yeah, we have no subsidies. Every once in a while, Stephen King will throw his weight around and say, well, this book has to be filmed in Maine. And then there'll be a scattered, usually like small budget movies. Probably the best one was In the Bedroom, which won, it was nominated for an Oscar, I guess. And that was filmed around where I live in Midcoast, Maine, by Todd Field, the director, who just did Tar with what's her name there? Cate Blanchett.
I had trouble reading this book without seeing Henry Fonda. Was Henry Fonda, wasn't it? I mean, you know, there he is. And in point of fact, Mike Bowditch's stepfather has purchased a nice property, which is the reason, well, you can describe all that. But I did think about that reading about Mike's stepfather. And in fact, one of the nice features of this book is that we have seen Mike through some rocky relationships. And one of them has been with his stepfather, but I really liked the way you wrote, you know, what's going on with them into the book. So why don't you tell us the occasion for Mike to be at Great Pond at all?
Okay. So anybody who's followed the series knows that Mike's love life has not been a model of consistency, to say the least. And don't draw comparisons with his creator. He's had this on again, off again relationship with Stacy Stevens, who is a wildlife biologist. She's now working as an EMT, but most importantly, she is the daughter of Mike's mentor, Charlie Stevens, the retired Vietnam War POW, retired chief game warden pilot for the state of Maine, and sort of quintessential old Mainer. And Charlie's wife, Aura Stevens. And so Mike's stepfather, his mom is dead. Mike was never very close to his stepfather. But, you know, Mike and Stacy have finally gotten engaged. And his stepfather and his new wife have decided that they should have some sort of a party, dinner party, for Mike and Stacy. And so they invite Charlie and Aura to their fancy new house on Great Pond for dinner. And Mike is trying to enjoy himself, but the screen door is open. It's a Labor Day weekend. Lots of stuff's going on out there. It's getting dark, and a jet skier is buzzing around, and he can't focus because he is Mike Bowditch, and you're not allowed to run a jet ski in Maine after dark, and it's driving him nuts. So he finally goes down, excuses himself, goes down to the water. Stacy follows him. And the jet skier moves off, but there are other boats out there in the lake. And as they're turning to go back to the party, they hear a thump. And they know what different sounds are like on a lake. You know, it's not a boat hitting another boat. It's not a boat hitting a rock. Could have been a boat hitting some kind of log, smaller log or something. Could have been a boat hitting a loon. You know, God forbid.
How big are the loons, by the way?
I mean, loons are big birds. Oh my gosh. I couldn't tell you in terms of pound wise, but they are, you know, if you see a loon sort of, yeah, a few feet long. I mean, it's in terms of their total sort of space that they occupy, their wingspan, I couldn't tell you. And, we have lots of them in Maine, quite a few. Mike goes out. Mike says, I have to find out what this thump was. It's going to drive me nuts if I don't know. And so the only boat at their disposal, because it's his father's house, stepfather's house, is his stepfather's brand new party boat. His stepfather has probably never has driven this probably twice. And it has, you know, I sort of picture it as this leisure craft with like the wet bar and the big screen TV and everything. And so they putter out into the lake in search of, they don't know what, maybe nothing. And instead, what they end up coming across is a severed human arm. So a body has been struck by a boat out there. The boat's gone. Where's the rest of the body? Whose body is it? And that's the beginning of Dead Man's Wake. Yeah. Ta-da.
Almost surely a dead body. I mean, with the arm missing.
Yeah. It's not he didn't swim away with that one arm.
No, no. So, I mean, this is really, right. This is really Paul's chance to have an underwater crime scene. I mean, you know, Mike has been in all kinds of different places in Maine, on islands and forests and all, but so far he hasn't been under freshwater anyway. And so I was really interested in, you know, for one thing, there's a lot of territorial law enforcement going on in this book, because we have wardens, we have the local police, we have the, you know, park ranger, you know. So there's a lot of conflict among the different people trying to seize jurisdiction and figure out who's what. What is Mike's actual, because he has a fairly limited official position.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the challenge of all these books, which is that game wardens in Maine are fully sworn officers of the law. They attend our Criminal Justice Academy alongside state troopers and sheriff's deputies. They have, you know, full arrest powers. They can arrest you for speeding or for murder. Typically what happens is if, you know, they come across a dead body and then the circumstances are suspicious, they hand it off to our state police. In this case, however, the one area, one of the areas that they are responsible for are fatal boating crashes. And so Mike immediately becomes the officer assigned to this case because he was present for it, and he's a warden investigator, and this is what they do. So one of the fun things for me was learning about boat crash investigations, about underwater recovery of bodies and objects. These are things that are, you know, very esoteric specialties of law enforcement, and you know, it's one of the fun things, obviously, about any kind of crime novel is you're always learning new things.
And also, he is saddled with a very young and ambitious and inexperienced, but key being ambitious, young guy.
Yeah. There's a lake constable in this book. Some of our lakes, you know, we have lots of lakes, not as many as Minnesota, but or Wisconsin probably. But there's a lake constable who's sort of in charge of driving around and making sure that people have their life vests on and aren't drunk and this sort of thing. And he's a young guy, and he barely got this job, but he sees this case, and he's also he arrives on the scene quickly as maybe his chance to get the job. He had applied to become a game warden, and they turned him down because of something in his past.
Like Mike turned him down.
Yes, in a way. Right. Yes.
I remember this book. Having just read. No, I mean, seriously, I think that's another interesting point of conflict, is that Mike, the guy got, you know, reasonable recommendations, but Mike felt there was something off about him. And there was some report from somewhere that made him question whether, I can't remember the guy's name, do you?
Yes, it's Galen Webb.
Thank you. Wonderful. I can't remember.
Fortunately, I came up with that one. Nothing more embarrassing for an author when you can't remember your own characters' names. Something happened. I don't want to give this piece of it away because it is important in the book, but something happened in his life that should have disqualified him from getting a job with law enforcement. It didn't. And it created doubts in Mike about this guy's, not just his professionalism, because he's brand new, he's young, but also his morals, his ethics. He doesn't trust him. And he has good cause, as it turns out in the course of the story, to be suspicious of him. I won't tell you again how that all works out because Barbara wants to sell this book, so.
Sold most of them, so I'm perfectly relaxed. But it's really interesting because we have Mike as a game warden investigator. We have the kid who's a lake constable and wannabe game warden. And then we have the local police. But then what's the role of the park? Isn't there a park ranger involved here too?
No, there's who else is in? Well, of course, the state medical examiner shows up in the scene.
Okay.
One of the things that I really found interesting was researching underwater searches for human remains, how that takes place, and learning how a dead body will travel in water over the course of time. So one of the things that, you know, a lot of people don't realize is what keeps you afloat initially is the air in your lungs. And once you die, you begin to sink a little bit. And things that affect your buoyancy, the buoyancy of a person or buoyancy of a... Weightlifters have a hard time swimming, which is one of the funny things about watching, like, you know, Dwayne Johnson as a lifeguard, is I'm sure he must just struggle in the water because he's so muscular. Muscles are heavy. Muscles will cause you to, you know, to sink. A baby, this is gruesome, but a dead baby will float because their fat to ratio is so high that they're buoyant. Yeah, and so I had to learn a lot about the specialty of finding dead bodies, how that takes place, both in terms of using underwater electronic equipment, how divers are dispatched, how they're taught to search. One of the things that's really fascinating is that, you can imagine all of the deaths that take place in fresh water, drownings and this sort of thing. And very often it's just, you know, your local fire department, your local police force that's called upon to deal with this situation. And what they don't realize, or they do realize it now, but they're not trained in, is the fact that this is a crime scene. And where the body has come to rest may indicate what happened, who is to blame. It's very important that the crime scene be preserved, that the body actually be left in place until such time as some things can be plotted out. And then when it's brought back to the surface, it needs to be enclosed in some sort of protective layer, because again, it might have fibers on it. It might have other indications of things that will tell the police, you know, what happened and like where it came from. So this is more of a police procedural than some of my other books, but it's a police procedural underwater.
Of course, Mike doesn't necessarily follow all of the rules for preserving crime scenes that he might. So that leads to even more conflict, could we say. Right. But he has his reasons, and, you know, they seem valid. So crucial to this whole thing is there is an island in the lake, and the island is kind of a pivot of what happens. And so the body may or may not be right near the island. And then the question is, what was the body actually doing? The guy, if it was a guy, what's he doing in the water near the island? Was he swimming? And so it goes.
Yes. And there begins, you know, with mysteries, you always have to be careful about how much you give away, right? But there may be an indication that the man on the island was with a woman, and perhaps the woman was not his wife.
Almost certainly the woman on the island.
And where is the woman?
No, I mean, I love investigating. I mean, I like police procedurals because they proceed in a linear fashion. You know, something happens and then you progress and you find out something and then something else, as opposed to some, you know, twisty and flashback stories where the action doesn't just follow a forward path. And I wouldn't want to read the same book all the time, but I do think, particularly right now when we're in an era of, I would say, heavy, not actually excessive, publication to really twisty thrillers and so forth, I'd really love to get a procedural where, you know, logic is at work and you can move forward. The other good thing too is you can put the book down and know when you pick it up, you're still moving forward. So, you know, you haven't lost your place or forgotten all the weird things that might be going on around it. So,
well, hopefully you will not put the book down at all.
Everybody can read a book in one sitting there, honey. Just because I do, I've ruined you. But nonetheless, but one thing I really like about the Mike Bowditch series is that they are different structures. They're not all police procedurals. You've got a couple of thrillers, you know. So I like the way that Paul, you know, changes up the structure of the stories.
You're one of the only people who realize that I do that, you know.
Well, I've read you in real time since the beginning. You know, sometimes after one of these events, somebody will come up to me and say, how'd you have time to look all that stuff up or, you know, whatever? And I'm going, I didn't look any of it up because I've read him every time he wrote a book. And I've loved the books. And I do think, you know, the characterizations have progressed in a reasonable. I told this will be one spoiler I am going to say. I told Paul that if I got to the end of this and the engagement was off, I was not going to read another Mike Bowditch. I was done. So there's the spoiler, is that all the things that happen in the book do not completely fuck up the engagement. So I was right on the wire there, but we're okay. But, you know, I mean, and the other thing is, too, that when you're writing a long series like this, you get to bring all kinds of characters forward. So, tragically, the wolf is not present at the lake. The wolf is not
appear.
A good traveler.
He doesn't. Yeah, he doesn't. But he will be for.
He's home being looked after.
Yeah. You know, I mean, this is the thing. One of the things that I try to do with the series in general, it's obviously fiction. I will take liberties for the sake of having a more streamlined story, but I like things to feel real. And if you, Mike's wolf dog, which is mostly a wolf, Shadow, is, you know, spent a couple of years in the wild, and I didn't want to transition him from being, you know, in danger of biting Mike's hand off to, you know, curling up with him by the fire at night. So it has to take some time. And the other thing is that Mike isn't going to, you know, necessarily put him in a crate and take him around on patrol either. So I have to get, you know, these are sort of problems of my own creation.
Swim?
Oh, yes.
See, I mean, there was a brilliant moment here where he could have, like, Shadow could have, like, off the dock into the lake, and it would have been really exciting, but sadly, he's summoned his
Well, head. One of the characters who recurs in this, I was really delighted to bring her back, is Mike's first sergeant, Kathy Frost, who was a favorite of a lot of readers. And Kathy is was a canine officer. And before she left the warden service, now she's a canine consultant. She travels around the world teaching law enforcement principally how to, you know, to train their dogs to be recovery dogs or rescue dogs. And her dog in this book is named Maple, and Maple is a recovery dog. And this gave me, again, something that I could depict that isn't, you know, it's not in a lot of stories, which is that a dog can scent a dead body through the water. you can take a dog out, you know, these trained recovery dogs, and the gases that are coming up will have molecules in it that the trained dog can identify and will signal that there is a body under the water. And it's an amazing thing. And I said, you know, I made Kathy, you know, I created this dog Maple, and she's a recovery dog. And what a wonderful opportunity to sort of bring her in and get her to sort of show her stuff in this story.
How many bodies might there be at the bottom of the lake? Really, I do absolutely think that she's great. Now, we haven't even touched on the bikers, because talk about conflict. There's yet another group. And if any of you are Kathy Reich's readers, or any of you read the Temperance Brennan series, because Kathy, when she's in Canada, has several of the early books featured bikers, which appeared to be partly because they are also drug traffickers across the border, you know, into Vermont. Archer Mayer deals with those in his incredibly good another series that, if you have not read it and you're waiting for the next book by Paul, let me recommend to you that you try Archer Mayer. We are 33 books into Archer Mayer, and he writes about Vermont the way Paul writes about Maine, but his guy is an actual cop.
Yeah.
But he's progressed from a small town Brattleboro cop all the way up to a special unit within the Vermont Police Force, you know. So, you know, for those of you who like series, isn't it great to follow, you know, the arcs of so many of the, including the dog, now too. I love that. And so we have Charlie and we have Aura, but I mean, I think realistically, you know, Charlie and Aura are aging along.
Yes, although, you know, when I created Mike Bowditch in The Poacher's Son, he was 24 and he's only 32 in book 14 here. So I am aging much more rapidly than Mike. It's like we used to be part of the same, not the same generation, but really close. And now I'm starting to get to be his father's age. So I don't know.
He couldn't do all the stuff he did if he got too old. I mean,
no.
This was a problem years ago. And if you read Nevada Barr's wonderful series with Anna Pigeon, well, she had to stop it because she aged Anna in real time. And when Anna hit like 50 something, Nevada recognized that Anna would not really be physically, you know, up to the kinds of things, because she took a lot of punishment in every book. And I do think, especially you have somebody like Mike who has to be very physical and all the rest of it. If you age him in real time every book, you're going to write him right into a desk job.
Well, and I have to say that, I have dealt out a lot of punishment to Mike Bowditch physically. I mean, he's going to end up like one of these pro football players whose knees don't work and everything else. People always ask me, you know, does Mike feel like a real person to you? And I said, yeah, actually he does. There are times where I sort of think I'm going to run into him, you know, at the gas station, and he'll be ahead of me in line, and he'll turn around and he'll know who I am and he'll punch me in the face because of all of the hell I've put him through, you know. And if he did, I would deserve it.
So you got a chance in this book to, you're a scuba diver, even if you don't do it often. So when you were writing about the underwater procedures and all, you did have some familiarity with it.
Yeah, you know, I learned some scuba diving in the Bahamas, and it's not something I do. Something I'd love to do a lot more. Maine is, you know, don't punish me, State of Maine Tourism Bureau, but Maine is not a great place to go scuba diving. You can't see anything. Lakes are boring. The ocean, you can see about 6 feet ahead of you in the water because it's so plankton filled, and it's a very rich, and it's cold. We get the Gulf Stream passes us by. It sort of curves off past Massachusetts and heads for Iceland and the west coast of Ireland and Scotland. And instead, we get the Labrador Current. Don't ask me how this all works, but so we get this, you know, this Arctic water. So it's very rare.
Which
that
it's good for lobsters.
It's good for lobsters. It's good for fish in general. That there's the only people who really want to swim in in the Gulf of Maine are typically under the age of 10. And they turn blue and their parents have to pull them out and say, you got to get out of there because you're dying of hypothermia.
Michigan was like that when I was a child. We went, you know, this was before air conditioning. Chicago, I mean, if you think Arizona's hot in the summer, try Chicago at 98 and raining. And Lake Michigan was always a source of cooling off. But I mean, on a good day, it might be 51. So it took a lot of courage, you know, to go to like Tower Road Beach in Winnetka or Cherry Breeze and drive off the pier. I was telling, I just think this is hilarious. I was telling Paul at brunch, my husband and I are going to do a Great Lakes cruise in September from Duluth to Toronto. I mean, I grew up on Lake Michigan and I've never been through all the lakes, almost every other body of water in the world, but not that. There are now not one, but two dive shops, scuba shops in Duluth, Minnesota for winter. Winter. That's, yeah, I mean, it really fascinated me. And it, whoever said there's no bad weather, you know, there's only bad clothing, wasn't kidding, because it all works because of the extraordinary insulation that the clothing can provide. So basically, Lake Superior in the winter casts up apparently these extraordinary waves towards Duluth. And so some enterprising guy from California has opened a surf. I love it. You know, a surf shop there.
Our surfing, we don't have much in the way of great surfing waves, except in the winter. So the people who are surfers in Maine, yeah, they put on their...
Every time I drive by Long Beach in York or whatever, you know, I went in January this year and I'm like, I was telling my friend, there's going to be surfers. And she's like, no. And all of a sudden we saw surfers. And I was like, it was freezing.
Yeah, not for me, but, you know, different strokes.
I mean, there are people who, you know, the Polar Bear Club in Chicago for Lake Michigan, you know, swimming in the whatever. And there's a British author named Claire McIntosh. She used to be a police officer. And she's writing a series set in Wales. And there's some kind of big body of water there. And their thing on New Year's Day, despite the, you know, Arctic temperatures, as the whole town disrobes and dives into the lake to start all over again. So, you know, there are people who really do think that somehow, you know, a cold water experience is
it's supposed to be good for
changing.
You, you know.
Right. So I don't know that we can actually say a lot more. We've talked about the multiple law enforcement agencies. We've talked about the dead body stuff. We've mentioned the bikers have a role. And I think I've mentioned that Mike and his stepfather actually develop a better relation. I thought that was, of the character arcs, that one was the one I thought was the most meaningful because everybody else, we've sort of already worked our way through them.
Well, one of the things about writing this series that I never expected when I started it was I create new characters, obviously, for every book. And what I didn't expect is that people will, you know, be interested and engaged by some of these secondary characters. And they'll start asking me, you know, when is Kathy coming back? Certainly everybody asks me, when's the wolf coming back? and so there's this pressure, you know, everybody has their favorite. And then there's also people in Mike's life that I haven't dealt with a whole lot. And one of them is his stepfather. His parents are dead. His stepfather is very different from Mike. He's a tax attorney in Portland, and you know he's affluent. And his idea of being an outdoorsman is playing, you know, 18 holes. And they haven't really clicked. And I thought, you know, I'm sort of curious about what their relationship is and should be. And again, it's this idea of trying to write a series that maybe feels realistic to the lives we actually live, which is that people, you know, remain in our lives, they leave our lives, they come back into our lives. And I just have wanted to depict that in the books. And so sort of it felt like a gap, like, okay, where is Mike with his stepfather? And how can I deal with that? And I'm really happy that you responded to that because that was important to the book.
Well, and not only that, the stepdad has remarried. So it isn't just the stepdad, but it's the stepmom.
Yeah, his step. I don't even know. There was this big dispute with the editors of this book, because is Mike's stepfather's new wife his stepmother, or is it his stepfather's wife? I mean, it was like trying to figure out how to refer to her.
Almost like a fourth cousin removed.
Yeah, exactly. And she is younger. She's actually closer to Mike's age, and Mike is totally prepared to hate her, except she's super cool. And worse, she is a yoga instructor and massage therapist, and she met Mike's stepfather on the massage table. She was giving him a massage, and they struck up a friendship and eventually a romance. And Mike thinks, oh God, she's a gold digger and everything. And she's
a really, really good character. I have thought one more thing we haven't discussed: flying.
Yes,
because Stacy, as you know, is a pilot, and
yes,
Charlie, of course, and Charlie has, of course, flown up to the Great Pond with Aura, because she's, well, for among other reasons, she can't travel easily because she's in a wheelchair. So there is, fortunately, the plane at hand.
Yeah, they've come in to this party via their Cessna, and it's a float plane. It's an amphibious plane, actually. So it's a float plane that has retractable wheels that you can use to land on strips, you know, or grass even, as long as it's not filled with here you'd have prairie dog holes, I suppose. I get to show that Stacy is also a pilot. She is a pilot, and so that plays a big important role towards the end of the book. It's with a lot of my books, it's sort of a slow build where I try to sort of create suspense, create tension, and then if you're looking for the action is going to happen later and later in the book. So hopefully you'll still be invested for when the guns start to go off and everything else. But that's all very deliberate. I'm not typically a writer who, you know, hits the gas on page one, although I have written those kinds of books as well in the series.
Do you all remember the scene where Stacy is working in Florida? And I'm trying to remember, what is it? It's the snake, python.
One Last Lie, it's called. Yeah.
Oh my God, that was your opener too. I mean, it was like the action all slowed after the python.
Yeah, Mike was in Florida as an investigator. One of their jobs is to vet potential game wardens, sort of, you know, do the background checks on these guys or women and say, you know, does everything add up, you know, in terms of their character. And he was down in Florida, and Stacy at that time was living in Florida, and she said, you want to go along on a python hunt, because the South Florida, sort of from Okeechobee Downs principally, has this massive problem with Burmese pythons, which, you know, there's dispute about how they got there. But one of the things that's irrefutable is that the Everglades is like the world's perfect environment to be a Burmese python. And so they're just running roughshod over everything. You know, they eat everything. It's always fun with any of these books to figure out a way to bring in something like, nobody would expect a python in a Mike Bowditch book, but I found a way.
It's a high action opener, let's put it that way. What was the name of that one?
That was One Last Lie.
Okay. Well, anyway, if you think that I was going to look it up, but you know, it was over there. So, So you are able to write high action scenes.
Oh yeah, and actually, the book, I'm not going to give anything away about the book that I'm currently working on, other than it's in the car. So anybody who has lock picking skills, in the audience, I decided this one's, I wanted to do another sort of very dramatic, not dramatic, but very suspenseful action thing again from the get go. So it will be a change of pace. I mean, one of my driving motives with the series, and this is something that Barbara was talking about, and I'm appreciative of this, is that I just don't want to write the same book twice. I want to play with the genre. I want it to feel like you're reading a Mike Bowditch book, but there's always something that's a little bit, a little different. And I don't do that just to amuse myself. I just, you know, I think it's, hopefully it adds to the reading experience as well.
Absolutely. Which is the book where we go into Acadia? Is it Dead by Dawn or Almost Midnight?
I have not done an Acadia book.
I thought when you went over to the, is it the, in, you went into Maine.
Oh. Well, he flies over Acadia at one point.
No, but when you're going across the border in Maine and there's all kinds
of...
Acadia,
that Acadia. That Acadia, yes.
I'm not totally crazy.
No, you're not. That's that was also one last lie. It's
It was in the same book?
Yeah.
We went from Florida to Canada.
Well, that's actually one of the things I said. Well, what if this book starts in the southernmost county in the United States... southeasternmost county in the continental United States and ends in the northeasternmost county in the United States. So that's one of the little
Yeah, but I love the fluidity things. Of the border. You know, I mentioned earlier that Maine is a border state. And in that book, I thought you really underlined the fact that there might be a legal border, but that doesn't mean that the people who live there are really... you know, paying that much attention to the border. Well, that was a terrific story.
Thank you. One of the things that people forget that Maine is a border state, probably because we don't make a lot of news as a border state that way. The other thing that they don't realize is that, I mean, you know, I could be wrong about this, but I'm fairly certain that I'm not, is that the Border Patrol trains all of its field officers on our southern border. And so they start there with the expectation that they're going to learn everything that they need to know, you know, in Arizona, in New Mexico, in Texas, and will be well equipped to deal with whatever they might have to deal with. Of course, to go from Nogales to Fort Kent, Maine, is a very different cultural experience. And, you know, so I think there have been more than one Border Patrol agent who's sort of gone up there, you know, and he's charged up with you know, for ready to rock and roll. And, you know, what he's dealing with are these little French-speaking ladies who are coming over across the border to get their hair cut. It's a very different vibe. You got like, I'm sure there are people up in those offices who are saying, okay, just take it down a notch, calm down, you know, it's a different world up here. And in fact, it's actually very tragic that one of the effects of 9/11 was that our border really got hardened in a way that was hard because you had families living, I mean, literally living across a river from each other. And they used to go back and forth the same way that you'd go, you know, to Phoenix from Scottsdale. And now they can't. There was actually a long time where they just could not go. And that's been loosened and improved over time, obviously. But it's
a tough issue. Do you all know the most porous part of the border of the United States? You're never going to guess this. I only know it because there's an author who wrote about it. Want to guess? It's not what you think. Detroit. Lake Huron. They can come right in. It's almost impossible to patrol the lake adequately. So, you know, we have all this attention on the Arizona border and the whole bit. But the truth is that, you know, we can't do it all. Stephen Mack Jones is a really interesting author who writes about Detroit. And that was the focus of one of his books, was how almost impossible it is to patrol, you know, the entry into the United States around Detroit. So, I mean, yeah, that's one of the great things about reading crime fiction is all the great stuff you learn that you would never, you know, normally you would never run across it. So, well, there we are. I mean, can't you imagine yesterday has already fomented at least one thriller in the eyes of, you know, both Brad Thor and Daniel Silva, who will be here in July. Both of their books are focused upon Russia. Daniel has always focused on Russia behind all of the other countries he's done. Brad has been looking at China from Norway, and he was in Afghanistan last time, but he too is in. And Martin Cruz Smith, the last Arkady Renko, Gorky Park, this is the 10th book since Gorky Park. He too is, you know, in the Ukraine and anticipating it. So, you know, when I was a child, the Cold War was, you know, we were trained to go under our desks at school and all that kind of stuff. And now here we are again, you know, circling back. But I think crime writers are very good at anticipating events and, you know, looking at trouble spots, but also looking at the ingenuity of criminals and trying to thwart modern forensics, because they really screw up a good, you know, it's so hard to write a book if you have to disable the cell phones and, you know, DNA can, I mean, there's some real problems with writing contemporary crime fiction. You either have to incorporate it or you have to dodge it one way or another. So Mike does a pretty good job. You know, part of it he can dodge because he's out in the wilderness, but some of it he has to pay attention to.
Yeah, you know, it is an issue, you know, in this day and age, because I think in a lot of authors really struggle with this, is that if everybody owns a cell phone, you know, it's hard to create a situation where somebody is isolated and can't get help. That's true of many places, but it's not true in Maine. I live on the coast, and I get a lousy cell signal. To the point where actually we still have a landline, because it's like we don't really trust that our cell phone is enough. So yes, that's real.
You've already heard there's going to be another book. That was going to be my closing question. So why don't we see if there are any questions that you and the audience would like to ask?
Raise your hand if you got a question.
Right here. Okay.
Well, I haven't seen you before, but how do you write? Do you write on a laptop? Do you?
I've always been a keyboard person. And in fact, so I knew that I wanted to be a novelist when I was around 11 or 12. And my parents gave me a Royal typewriter, a manual typewriter, which I still own. I don't use, but it's in my office. And so I graduated from manual typewriters to electric typewriters to word processors to computers. And I've never written longhand. I do. I've been writing full time. I left my day job back in 2013, I think. I've learned that it's very important for me to have an office to go to, because it's my job and I need to sort of get into the mindset of, you know, getting into work and have a place where I can just focus on work. And my office is actually it's in a marina. That it repairs boats, but it also has yachts that come in, and there's always something crazy going on at the marina. Gordon Ramsay was there not a year ago or whatever. Like, everybody's excited. Everybody from the marina was like running out to get a glimpse of Gordon Ramsay. But this is the thing, is that there's, as Barbara was talking, you know, when you do this research for books, but at a certain point you have to write the book. And that for me requires going into a closed room and trying to eliminate my distractions and doing it. See these bags under my eyes? No, it's like anything else, you know, it's, I think writing a novel is something, the more that you do it, you learn how to do it. And one of the things that, for instance, that I did learn about research was I can't research everything to the extent that I might want to. I can only research, in order to write a book a year, I have to figure out what I need to know and do that research. You know, I had a book, there was a book that The Precipice is set on the Appalachian Trail. And it's a section of the Appalachian Trail in Maine called the 100-Mile Wilderness. And, you know, early on in my career, I would have said, oh, my God, how am I going to write about the Appalachian Trail? I'll have to hike the whole thing in order to write this book. And fortunately for me, I said, wait a minute. I don't need to hike the whole Appalachian Trail. I'm only writing about this section. Mike Bowditch has not hiked the Appalachian Trail. He's only responsible for this part of it. That's all I need to know about. So,
where in Maine did you grow up?
So I grew up in, my family is from Sanford, which is in very southernmost Maine, right on the New Hampshire border. I grew up in a town called Scarborough, which is a suburb of Portland. I went to high school in Portland. And I've been steadily, as the years have moved on, I've been steadily moving east along the coast. I'm currently in the town of Camden, and I often joke that by the time I die, I'm going to be in Eastport, which is the easternmost city in the United States. I seem to be drifting that way. But Southern Maine has changed a lot too since I was a kid. It feels much more like an extension of Greater Massachusetts, Greater Boston, which is wonderful, you know, in some ways. But it's as somebody who sort of has an idea in their mind about, you know, what it feels like to be in Maine, I prefer that's our slogan, Maine the way life should be.
Where did you come up with the name Bowditch?
So Bowditch was an interest. I was looking for a name for the character for a long time as I was writing the first book. The only thing I knew was I wanted a name that sounded like a New England name. And although some people have said to me, "Oh, is he Polish?" And like it's like, well, if it was, you know, Bodicz, maybe. But there was a cemetery off of Route 1 that I passed routinely, the Bowditch Cemetery. And I saw it and just said, you know, that could be a good name for this character. And so he became Mike Bowditch. I didn't know anybody with that personally with that last name. I'd seen it. Subsequently, everybody that I've met who has that name pronounces it Bowditch or Bowditch. So he is the only and I always take, if I ever meet them, I say, well, you don't want to be related to this guy anyway. Just think of him as your poor relation. And in Stephen King's book, Fairy Tale, he has a Bowditch and it Howard Bowditch. And I think it must be pronounced Bowditch, not Bowditch. So.
I always wondered in my head. Yeah. Was I saying it right?
And the funny thing is that, of course, nobody can pronounce my own last name. So here I go and create a character that also people struggle to pronounce his last name. Like, how did I do that?
Anybody else?
Can you pronounce your last name, just for the record?
Yeah, and actually, we're going to do this in two parts. Because this is an interactive thing. When I was growing up, my father belonged to a generation of Franco-Americans who were discriminated against in the state of Maine. I mean, there were signs in windows that said no French need apply.
Yes.
And it was, you know, so he was raised to try to, French was his first language. He was taught to try to get rid of his French accent. He never taught us French, which I'm sad that, but I understand why he didn't. So what he told us when we were growing up was, tell people, you know, people are going to have trouble with your name, so tell them it's pronounced, do I run? You know? And I noticed, however, that my mémé, my great aunt, not my grandmother, pronounced it Dwarren. And when I hit my 20s, I said, well, she's old. She's like an original Dwarren. She knows how to pronounce her own name. I should pronounce my name like she's pronouncing it. And so I don't go Dwarren, I say Dwarren. So it's a Frenchified thing. However, I have a distant cousin a very distant cousin in the audience. We're probably separated by about 10, 15 generations. And I would like to know how you pronounce your last name.
Douaron.
Douaron. See, it's more, even more French. He's a Cajun, so he gets, he, you know.
You yeah. have to do the nasal thing at the end, so it's yes. Douaron.
Yeah, it's right? actually, so we are Acadians. We are from the Nova Scotia area. Back when the French colonized it, the British, when they took control of that part of, you know, what eventually became Canada, it was, they deported many of the French colonists. And so, of course, famously, you know, a lot of them ended up in Louisiana and became the Cajuns. And I belonged to the branch of the family that went running into the woods and hid until the ship stopped taking people away. And so, yeah, so you have Acadians up in New Brunswick, primarily Canada. And then, of course, you have them here. So there, you can find Douarans in the Lafayette phone book, and you can find Douarans in, you know, in the...
There's a lot of mangled French throughout the United States.
Yes, there is.
We could talk about Versailles, Kentucky. We could talk about Prairie du Chien, Iowa. You know, I mean, there are any number of places. French, you know, is, I think, a beautiful language. I've spoken it practically all my life, and I'm always amused at, you know, the variations of it. But a lot of it depends on where people settled. And if you think about it, LaSalle and all, they came down the Mississippi. So there was a huge, you know, French influx that came down through Middle America, hence, you know, Prairie du Chien. Iowa, where's the one in Illinois? I'm trying to remember. There's a really weird name in Illinois somewhere. But anyway, you know, those are results of, you know, the French explorers coming down there. I mean, if Napoleon hadn't sold, you know, that huge part of the United States to Jefferson, it might still be French. So many accidents on the way to us becoming a completely united nation. Spanish at this end, British at that end, you know, French in the middle, whatever. So, right. Was there any online question, Patrick? You need the microphone. All right.
All right. So first of all, August says greetings from Maine. So cousin of yours. Also, question came online about movie deals. And do you have anything? Do you have anything in the pipeline? And if not, or if so, do you have any desire for certain actors to play Mike and your cast of characters, or would you just let fate decide?
Oh, fate. I don't trust fate that way either. So when I was writing The Poacher's Son, I was so focused on that. The Poacher's Son is actually structured as a screenplay. And it has three acts. It has an inciting incident. It has, if you know anything about script writing, it has a midpoint. And I thought for sure somebody was going to turn The Poacher's Son into a movie. They never did. And I had ideas in my head about who actors, you know, actors who might play Mike Bowditch back then. Now, what's happened is that they are now all in their mid-40s or late-40s, you know, and so they are disqualified. Over the years, there have been sort of, you know, people have come forward. Before the pandemic, I got very close to, some producers that I entered into a deal with who were shopping a show to HBO and Netflix and that sort of thing. And then the pandemic sort of temporarily disrupted a lot of Hollywood. And of course, it ended up being very good for TV content ultimately, but my series got lost in the wash. There's something currently going on. We'll see if it goes anywhere. I have no preference. I mean, I shouldn't say I have no preference for who plays Mike Bowditch. I would love to be pleasantly surprised by a great actor who's more than just a handsome guy.
The writer's strike right now makes it impossible for anything to be happening. So, you know, depending on how long it goes, it could set projects back for years. But I think that Maine, which is the main character in this series, and Mike, you know, are made for streaming television. So, you know, we'll just have to see how it goes. But
yeah, I mean, fortunately for me, it's, you know, it's not, if it happens, it happens. I write the books. I enjoy writing the books. streaming TV show gets made, I will not be writing it, so it won't be me anyway. You know? Yeah, but I wrote this. That people just haven't recognized it yet.
Well, when they do streaming, they don't necessarily follow the books chronologically. If you've watched the Harry Bosch series, you know, they're kind of a mashup, the CJ Box thing, Joe Pickett going on. There's, I think, 3 books involved in the second era. So, you know, it wouldn't be necessarily the case that they would do book after book after book. So, and unfortunately, the real writer doesn't get a voice in all of it. It, you know, depends on what the TV people want to do. Well, thank you all very much for your attention this afternoon. At least it was cool inside, right? And so if you would like Paul to sign your book or you want to take photos with him, I'm just going to clear this out of the way so he can sign it right here. So thank you for coming. Thank you, virtual audience. And I hope you
thank you, everybody.
Go home and read a really good book, possibly one by Paul Doiron.
Oui.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.